The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 19th of August 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, broadcasting to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up, Russia rejects calls to demilitarise the area around Europe's biggest nuclear plant. Could it cause a catastrophe in Ukraine? Also ahead, Monocle's Balkans correspondent Guy Delorne will have an update on top-level talks between Kosovo and Serbia. Plus, the business news, and Andrew Muller will be telling us about some of the news cycle's stranger offers.
We learned that former US vice president and possible Martian spy who didn't pay enough attention during the How to Act Like an Earthling lessons Mike Pence may actually have a sense of humour.
All that right here on The Briefing, live from London. In the past few hours, Russia has rejected calls to demilitarise the area around the Zaporizhia nuclear plant in southern Ukraine. It comes amid growing concern over Europe's largest nuclear plant. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said that any damage to the site would be catastrophic. Well, let's get the latest now with Monocle's Kyiv correspondent, Olga Tokariuk. Thanks as ever for joining us, Olga. What is the situation at the plant right now?
Hello, Georgina, and hello, everyone. Thank you for having me. Well, the situation is pretty worrying. Yesterday, Russia announced that there might be some provocation, as they called it, by the Ukrainian side at the nuclear power plant today. And Ukrainian military intelligence warned that Russia today will not bring to the station its personnel, also from Russian atomic energy Rosatom, that was present at the station from the day of its occupation by Russia in early March. So only a limited number of service personnel, only Ukrainian personnel, is at the plant today. However, there are no other news today what is actually happening there. But the tensions were obviously rising. This coincides also with the visit of the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to Ukraine and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. They discussed the issue of the situation at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant during the talks yesterday. And again, Guterres, the UN Secretary General, called on Russia to demilitarize the area around the plant, which Russia today rejected.
How likely do you think a nuclear catastrophe is?
Well, it's hard to say, but the situation is obviously very worrying. We know for sure there is evidence of that, that Russia has been stationing weapons at the territory of the plant. There is Russian military personnel. Russia has put in a lot of pressure on the employees of the station. We know about cases of kidnappings and even some employees in the interviews and condition of anonymity with various media in Ukraine, but also international media such as BBC. They mentioned that some of the employees were effectively tortured and killed by Russians. So this information, of course, is very difficult to verify. So these are accounts from the employees who are still there. So it is clear that the situation is very tense, very dangerous when you have weapons, you have shelling, you have military personnel at the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe. Well, that, of course, is very worrying.
Now, there was a press trip to the region recently and we saw photographs of workers preparing for the worst case scenario. How might they try and contain it?
It's in the hands of Russia and Russian military. What happens there at the station? Ukrainian government has been warning that Russia has begun preparations to disconnect the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant from the Ukrainian grid. This transition, if they disconnect it, they might try to connect it to some generators before trying to connect it to the Russian grid. But, you know, it's a very delicate process, and any error in it can lead to catastrophic consequences.
And what are the ramifications for the power supply in Ukraine?
Before the invasion, Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant has been supplying about one-fifth of the energy needs of Ukraine. So you can imagine how significant is that. And now territories of Ukraine that are under Russian occupation in southern part of the country, also in parts of Donetsk and Luhansk regions, are left, parts of those territories are left without electricity. And, you know, it's still the summer. As the autumn gets closer, the winter season gets closer, there can be and will probably be more and more problems with securing electricity and heating supply.
Now, Russia, of course, rejects the fact that it is shelling the region. It says that this is Ukraine's fault.
Yes, Russia has been stressing that. Ukraine, of course, responds that it is Russia that is shelling the plant. Again, quoting the interviews of the employees who are still there, who are working at Enerhodar, because this is the town where the nuclear power plant is located. And so these employees, they were saying in their interviews that Russia is imitating the shelling of the station to blame Ukrainian forces for that. So they do that. They do it in a way so they are possible. So it is possible to present it as if it were Ukrainian shellings.
Mm. Now, of course, Chernobyl is in Ukraine, and we all know what happened then. How would a disaster at Zaporizhzhia affect the rest of the world? Would it be on the same scale as Chernobyl?
It's very hard to say at this point because we don't know, you know, it will depend on the, hopefully it will not happen. But if it does, it will depend on the scale of the potential radioactive leak. As I said, this is the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe, and there were some projections made by Ukrainian experts also how this radioactive cloud could move considering current weather and current direction of wind. So they made a projection for the next 3 days, and the projection was that this nuclear radioactive cloud would move towards the west of Ukraine, potentially also affecting parts of Baltic countries, Belarus, Poland, Romania, Moldova, even moving to Central Europe, to Hungary and Austria.
And just finally, I mean, looking at the situation as a whole, is there any way in which Russia is justified in saying that it's safer not to demilitarize?
Well, Russia says that they have to remain there. The military personnel has to remain there to protect the station from Ukrainian attacks, which makes little sense because it is Russia that installed its military personnel there in the first place. There was no danger. There were no shellings and no weapons close to the nuclear power plant prior to Russia's invasion. It's very difficult to take Russia's words seriously, and especially the fact that it's rejecting the calls to demilitarize the area around the station. It seems that Russia is not interested in actually ensuring the security of nuclear power plant, that it is using it for nuclear blackmail to push Ukraine and international community towards some concessions, towards some sort of a deal with Russia.
Olga, thank you very much indeed. That was Monocle's Kyiv correspondent, Olga Tokariuk. Now, here's Carlotta Rabello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Georgina. Powerful storms have hit large parts of central and southern Europe, killing at least 12 people. Authorities have reported fatalities in Italy, Austria and on the French island of Corsica. The storms follow record-breaking temperatures across much of the continent. A new poll suggests that Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva remains the frontrunner to win Brazil's presidential election in October, although the country's current leader, Jair Bolsonaro, is gaining ground. Bolsonaro has been attempting to lure floating voters by passing a major spending package. And finally, Colombia is considering introducing a new digital currency. The move, which forms part of the country's new monetary policy, aims to make transactions easier and combat tax evasion. However, it is not clear what kind of digital currency the Colombian government will be looking to launch. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Georgina.
Thank you very much, Carlotta. Now, talks to end hostilities between Kosovo and Serbia in Brussels have concluded without agreement. Both the European Union and NATO have been trying to mediate in the dispute, which stems from Kosovo's attempts to make it mandatory for everyone, including Serbs living in Kosovo, to hold Kosovan documents. Well, let's get the latest now with Monocle's Balkans correspondent Guy Delorne. Guy joins us on the line from Slovenia's Lake Bled. Guy, tell us about these meetings. Some of them, it seems, extremely short.
Yeah, well, I was joking on that on Twitter yesterday. I saw the EBS service, which is the European Union's broadcasting service, was showing bilateral meetings between Josep Borrell, the foreign policy chief for the EU, and Prime Minister Kurti of Kosovo and President Vucic of Serbia, and showing these lasting for a matter of seconds. I don't think it was really quite that brief, but it did provide at least a funny moment when you're following these things from afar.
Mm. And what were you getting? What was the read out from your following of the events?
Well, it was exactly as I expected, to be honest with you. Beforehand, I was saying that I doubted anything would come out of this meeting and we'd be in for a couple of weeks more of tensions. And this is simply because there's no real deadline until the 1st of September. And that's when Kosovo says this time we're really going to make people in Kosovo, ethnic Serb or otherwise, use Kosovo-issued number plates and Kosovo-issued IDs. So everybody knows we've got a couple of weeks of wiggle room here. And all the noise coming beforehand from Pristina, the capital of Kosovo, was that Prime Minister Kurti was not willing to discuss anything except mutual recognition with Serbia. That was it. And it does seem that he was very unwilling to move on anything yesterday, if you believe what's coming out of the Serb media. But we haven't really had anything from Kosovo to say what they did talk about. All you can say is when you see what Josep Borrell said afterwards, he was clearly rather cheesed off with the fact that he was having to deal with this crisis over number plates at a time when there's a war on in Ukraine.
Mm. Do you think the fact that NATO was involved indicates just how serious the dispute between Kosovo and Serbia actually is?
What it did was it provided actually an opportunity for agreement between Kosovo and Serbia, agreement on the fact that they think that NATO's presence in Kosovo is a good thing. Kosovo, because it wants to show that it can cooperate with NATO and be on the path towards membership of NATO. Of course, it isn't a member of a lot of international organizations right now because many countries don't recognize its unilateral declaration of independence from Serbia. Serbia, on the other hand, likes having NATO troops in Kosovo because they guarantee the safety of ethnic Serb people living in Kosovo. And time and again, we've seen that KFOR, these NATO peacekeepers, have guaranteed that people who are ethnic Serb in Kosovo can go about their business without fear that they're about to be pushed out, as happened in 2004, for example.
Guy, you were just saying that the fact that NATO is involved is actually quite reassuring to the people of Kosovo and Serbia. And you also mentioned that there is still time to resolve this. The deadline is only the 1st of September. What exactly must happen by that date?
Well, people need to get their act together. It's clearly not going to be acceptable to ethnic Serbs living in Kosovo or to Serbia, the idea that everybody's going to have to switch over to Kosovo-issued license plates at that point. That just would be a line that people would not be willing to cross. So some sort of compromise needs to be found. And it's going to be quite difficult to do that, I think, in some respects, particularly bearing in mind that Prime Minister Albin Kurti of Kosovo has taken a very hard line on everything to do with relations with Serbia since he took office. I mean, he's a committed Albanian nationalist. He has no love for Serbia whatsoever, and he's shown very little willingness to compromise so far. I would suspect the fact that we've heard very little from Kosovo since the meeting with Josep Borrell indicates that a lot of talking is going on behind the scenes, particularly with the involvement of the European Union and the United States, to try and work out some sort of way that we can move forward with some sort of face-saving compromise. But bearing in mind Albin Kurti's statements until now, it may be quite difficult to find that.
Mm. We know that this has provoked some unrest on the ground. And I just wonder, finally, what the impact of that will be on the rest of the region and indeed Europe as a whole.
Well, Josip Borrell said it's important to find an agreement between Kosovo and Serbia, not just for stability in the region, but for stability in Europe as a whole. It doesn't do anybody any good to have these concerns about this small pocket, really, in the Western Balkans, but where things could go sideways if things go wrong, if the wrong person at the wrong time loses their head. Bad things could happen, not necessarily hugely bad things, but certainly distractingly bad ones. And Europe doesn't need that at a time like this. Both of these countries, Kosovo and Serbia, want to join the European Union. Serbia's deep into membership talks. They both need to show that they are capable of acting as members of the European Union.
Guy, thank you very much indeed. That's Guy Delaunay. And this is The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Tune in to Monocle on Culture, where we grill our panel of critics to get the inside line on the best in the world of film, music, art, literature and more.
It's just got this synth section that kind of makes you want to swing through the saloon doors straight to the dance floor.
I appreciate that some of the most brilliant art, most of it, grounds you in this moment and makes you confront it.
With industry insiders and the odd bit of reportage too, it's bound to keep the most discerning of culture vultures very well fed.
Why'd You Come In Here Looking Like That is a song that is absolutely going to make you want to put on a pair of tight jeans and go boot scooting, even if it's just in your front room.
Monocle on Culture, premiering Mondays at 20:00 London time here on Monocle 24 and available thereafter wherever you get your podcasts.
You're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Georgina Godwin, and we'll get the latest business news now with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, another very low reading for UK consumer confidence. Tell us more.
Hi, Georgina. Yeah, consumer confidence falling to record lows in the UK as household finances are squeezed by soaring inflation. Remember, earlier this week, we got that 10.1% reading on inflation for the year to July, the first time it's hit double digits in more than 40 years. Now, the consumer confidence gauge from GfK came in 3 points lower in August at minus 44. Now, that was the lowest since they started the survey back in 1974. The story on inflation, well, that is pretty gloomy. The Bank of England thinks that price growth will top 13% in the coming months. And the final calculations are currently being made to the energy price cap, which comes into place in October. Now, we think that that's going to increase by 80%, 80%. So fuel bills, power and gas will go up by 80% in October. That will mean that winter fuel bills in the UK will probably be about twice their level of last winter. And they weren't cheap back then either. So the inflation story is pretty gloomy. As to the wider economy, well, there are some signs that things may not be quite as bad as the inflation picture suggests. Interesting story in The Economist recently, a bit of analysis about some of the things which are propping up consumer spending. The Economist says that households in the rich world probably have excess savings of some $3 trillion accumulated during the pandemic. People still have some pandemic savings, that money they put aside and they didn't spend during the pandemic. And in America, cash balances of poorer households are some 70% higher in March than they were in 2019. So in America, at least, there's some evidence that excess savings does go across the board. And also some survey evidence also from America that an unusually low share of people believe they'll be unable to meet their debt commitments over the next 3 months. So some signs that people do have money to cushion them over the difficult winter months. But the key question in many investors' minds and economists' minds is when consumer spending will fall off a cliff. And it certainly doesn't seem to have done so yet.
Yeah. Now, if those who do have a little cushion have been investing in Bitcoin, that might have been a mistake because the value of top cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin, has plummeted.
Cryptocurrency is having rather a bad day today. Something of a sharp sell-off. Of course, cryptocurrencies are incredibly volatile, so this is not particularly unusual. But Bitcoin currently down just over 8% today. Global markets really retreating on the back of growing uncertainty about the direction of monetary policy. Ether and some of the smaller virtual coins seeing even sharper declines today. Crypto has staged quite a recovery since June, along with a lot of other risk assets. But that is looking increasingly fragile as traders struggle to get a direction on the sense of direction on the Fed's monetary policy. In case you missed it, stocks have had an incredible rally over the course of the summer. Since June, stocks, the S&P 500 in America, up some 17%. That was after a very sharp sell-off earlier this year on concerns about the global economy and, of course, the Federal Reserve and other central banks ramping up interest rate rises. But a sense of optimism over the last couple of months that perhaps things may not be so bad, and perhaps when we reach a turning point, perhaps early next year, then interest rates will come down. But still some uncertainty about when that will come about. So I think just the market's just going into something of a holding pattern now while they just wait to see where the Federal Reserve is going next. I should point out that interest rates are going up further across the world. There's no doubt about that. But the question is when that will end and then how quickly they will come down on the other side.
Ewan, thank you very much. Lovely to talk to you as ever. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts, and you're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally on today's programme, it's time to join Monocle's Andrew Muller for his take on what the past 7 days have taught us.
We learned this week that everything in the United Kingdom is basically fine, that there are no real problems at all, no drought or double-digit inflation or skyrocketing energy bills or general cost of living crisis or war at barely one remove with Russia or anything like that, and if there is, it's no big deal. We learned this by judging from the behaviour of the UK's clearly serenely unconcerned Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who, apparently insufficiently refreshed by one holiday in Slovenia, come on, let's have some Balkan folk music, something accordion-y. Christ alive, what a din. Embarked on another holiday, this one in Greece. Seamless. We learned other things from Johnson's gallivanting. We learned that the British media and the public it serves have lost none of their blind, furious, purple-templed, vein-throbbing rage at the thought of their elected representatives enjoying life even slightly, which is why prime ministers are so very often obliged to spend such time off as they get, pretending to be absolutely overjoyed that they're freezing half to death on a rain-swept Cornish promontory and not sloshing back an agreeable Montepulciano on the sun-splashed balcony of a Tuscan villa. But we learned, or rather conceded, that on this occasion the grimly grudge-toting denizens of these angry islands do have half a point, specifically that Boris Johnson could probably bestir himself to do some actual governing right now, as if we're being honest, things aren't going brilliantly, plus his schedule is shortly to free up dramatically by dint of him not being Prime Minister anymore, unless one assumes that he intends to dedicate himself with tireless, up-all-hours diligence to the concerns of the voters of his constituency of Uxbridge and South Ruislip. If Johnson happens to be listening, it's in West London. We learned, meanwhile, that Johnson's increasingly inevitable successor, Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, does not think much better of Britain's people than Britain's people tend to of their politicians. We learned from the leak of a recording from circa 2019 that Truss believes her fellow citizens to be, and we paraphrase somewhat for clarity, a woebegone sack of shiftless, bone-idle layabouts who would, by and large, recoil from an offer of generously paid work as a mattress tester.
No. Because this has been a historical fact for decades. Yeah. Essentially, it's partly a sort of mindset and attitude thing. Yeah, it's working culture, basically.
But if we have learned anything about Liz Truss, Liberal Democrat turned Conservative, Republican turned Monarchist, Remainer turned Brexiter, person who once pronounced it scone but now pronounces it scone, person who once put the cream on the scone before the jam but now puts the jam on the scone before the cream.
What?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. What? I don't know that one.
Really? No.
Okay, sure.
These monologues aren't delivered under oath. We have also learned that Truss is a politician of commendably flexible ideological underpinnings, and were therefore rather anticipating from her a screeching handbrake turn into ecstatic raptures at the positively Stakhanovite heroics of the British worker. We learned that we were to be disappointed.
You suggested in that leaked recording that British workers weren't working hard enough. Do you believe that?
Well, what I believe is that we need
more skills in our country, we need more capital investment in our country, we need more opportunity in our country.
And that is our British workers working.
That is what I would deliver as Prime Minister. Look, we need to help more people get into work. We have a number of people across the country who are currently economically inactive.
One more chance. Do you think British people don't work hard enough?
I've already been clear that what I want to see is more opportunity across this country.
Anyway, contemplating the Atlantic's other shore in expectation of bleak comic relief, we learned that former US vice president and possible Martian spy who didn't pay enough attention during the How to Act Like an Earthling lessons, Mike Pence, may actually have a sense of humor. Ex-Veep Pence floated the richly amusing possibility that he might at some point bowl along to the House committee investigating the events of January 6th, 2021, during which his former boss, President Benito Cartman, neglected to try terrifically hard not to get him lynched. Hail Columbia, happy land. Hail ye heroes, heaven born band. Fought and bled in freedom's cause. Fought and bled in freedom's cause. We learned that, however, that Vice President Pence, or Lieutenant Colonel Zorg of the Mars Intelligence Agency, whichever, has also paid somewhat lackadaisical attention to American history. And let's have a sound effect of a blackboard eraser being angrily flung at a diffident student by an enraged tutor. Ah, memories. For we learned when we checked that loads of, well, several current or former presidents and vice presidents have testified on Capitol Hill, including Presidents Abraham Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, Gerald Ford, Teddy Roosevelt, and William Taft, and Vice President Schuyler Colfax. So it would not be unprecedented. It would not even be un-vice precedented. But we learned that Pence, or Zorg, whoever, had better be quick, for we learned that Congresswoman Liz Cheney, daughter herself of a previous Republican vice president, will not be around to chair the January 6th committee much longer, having lost the Wyoming Republican primary ahead of November's midterms to some Trumpist headbanger, specifically this one.
Joe Biden is the largest or the most destructive human trafficker in our history.
Yes, we played cuckoo noises behind that. We are that childish. So we learned that we have lived long enough to see not only Liz Cheney, who would have been generally regarded not so long ago as a fire-breathing paleoconservative, resemble by comparison to her party at large a bastion of principle and voice of reason.
2 years ago, I won this primary with 73% of the vote. I could easily have done the same again. The path was clear, but it would have required that I go along with President Trump's lie about the 2020 election. It would have required that I enable his ongoing efforts to unravel our democratic system and attack the foundations of our republic. That was a path I could not and would not take.
But also her dad.
In our nation's 246-year history, there has never been an individual who is a greater threat to our republic than Donald Trump. He tried to steal the last election using lies and violence to keep himself in power after the voters had rejected him. He is a coward. A real man wouldn't lie to his supporters. He lost his election and he lost big. I know it, he knows it, and deep down, I think most Republicans know it.
Welcome to the resistance, Mr. Vice President. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you very much to Andrew. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing, which was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our researcher was Tamsin Howard and our studio manager was Nora Hall. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time, but I'll be here with regular news updates across the weekend, plus Monocle on Saturday and indeed Monocle on Sunday, where I'll be joined by our editorial director, Tyler Brulé. I'm Georgina Godwin. Goodbye and thank you for listening.